Good afternoon. We have several consolidated cases this afternoon. United States v. Scarfo, Falullo, Maxwell et al. And numbers 15-2811, 2826, 2844, 2925, and 19-1398. And I think we're starting with Mr. Riley. Is that correct?
I believe so, Judge.
Whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
For the record, my name is Mike Riley, and I defended Nick Scarfo, Jr. in the matter before the court.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
And you're on question four that we sent out, is that correct?
I'm sorry, sir?
Question four, is that the one you're...
Yes, that's correct.
Very good.
I know my time is somewhat limited, but I think possibly a little bit of background as to the relationship of Scarfo and Mano might help us when we go into the areas that we had to confront in the course of the trial. I don't know how familiar the court is with Don Mano, but... Don Mano.
But he had represented him for what, 20 years?
Yes, he did. But just so you know, it was quite a long relationship. And Mano had quite a reputation in the sense he was a former assistant United States attorney. He'd served during the Vietnam conflict as a Marine JAG officer. Quite an outstanding record. He spent a lot of his professional time defending individuals charged with criminal matters. That was his primary focus. We find ourselves in a situation where the government brought an extensive, monstrous indictment and prosecution against a number of individuals, including Mr. Scarfo and Mr. Mano. Now, as the court...
We do have some limited time, so if you don't mind, let's jump into the questions, okay?
Very well.
Help me understand why, since... it seems to be conceded all the way around that Mr. Scarfo had unconflicted independent counsel during the trial, the entirety of it.
Right.
He is somehow deprived of his Sixth Amendment right to counsel. What if you've got anything? Maybe it's a due process argument, right? But how is there a Sixth Amendment argument here?
I think, sir, what we're looking at is it's a confluence of a number of different issues. And it has to do with Mano's participation in the trial and Mano's history with him and Judge Kugler's attempt to determine whether or not there was, in fact, a conflict. So the focus essentially is
related to... But Mano wasn't... This is why you're actually putting your finger right on my logical difficulty here. I don't understand... Well, let's start... What does the Sixth Amendment guarantee?
Look, it guarantees you counsel and effective assistance of counsel.
Okay.
And the issue that
and,
most...
And did he get effective assistance of counsel? Did he have unconflicted counsel?
My opinion is yes, so that's correct. But the issue, it gets broader because we have Mano as a co-defendant and the situation...
But not as counsel.
No, not as counsel, but as prior counsel in some of the same issues that were before the court.
So help me. How is that a Sixth Amendment issue? How does the fact that somebody you used to have as counsel end up as your co-defendant implicate the Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel in that case? I can understand an argument that hey, this is going to bring up things that are awkward and we may have issues between us that make him unable to say what he ought to say, or if he does say it, that would conflict with my rights in some broader due process context, but I'm just not seeing it. I mean, and I don't mean to be obtuse. My colleagues may have a fix on it, but help me get the Sixth Amendment issue.
If I could point to the September 2012, we reference it as the robing room transcript. And what happened in that robing room transcript was Mr. Mano and the prosecutors were probing room by Judge Kugler, and there was an exclusion of all of the counsel. And in the course of that conversation, which I believe is part of the appendix.
But you have a transcript of that meeting.
Yes, sir. That's
is there anything that you can point to in that transcript that was improper or that directly concerns Mr. Scarfo's rights?
The issue became conversationally during the course of that meeting whether or not Mr. Scarfo could testify. Would he be in a position to testify? And the problem that he had, of course, was having his prior counsel, a defendant who has an interest separate from his own, in a position to cross-examine him. And at that point, our exclusion from that conference, when Judge Kugler had that conference, put us in a situation where how can you effectively represent somebody when you've been excluded from a conference which discusses the nature of your client's rights to testify and to have representation?
Let's go back to Judge Jordan's question. Essentially, if it's a Sixth Amendment right, Mano has a right to adequate counsel. In this case, it was himself. Obviously, he did quite well. And then Mr. Scarfo has a right to his own counsel, and he had that counsel. So even if there was something here, what would your remedy have been?
Well, the remedy is a recognition as it relates to other aspects of my argument that Mr. Scarfo knew that he could not testify, obviously for obvious reasons with Mano.
What would your remedy have been if there was a problem?
Well, I think the remedy, the issue should have been alerted to sooner, and Mano could have been, his case could have been severed, which is what he was requesting on two separate occasions.
But when I look at your brief, it looks to me like on page 19 you're saying you're not challenging the district court's severance decision.
No, we're not at this point. But at
any point, the quote is, appellant does not challenge the district court's decision to deny Mano's motion seeking to sever his trial from that of his clients, period. That sounds like a clear waiver. It's not a forfeiture. It's like an outright, we know what we're doing, and we waive it.
I think the issue becomes, how did the court deal with an apparent, and turns out to be a per se conflict? And Judge Kugler was aware of that because he talks about it in the roving room documents, and in which he discusses, and I could read portions of it to you.
I don't think I heard you answer that question. It seems to me that when there is a problem at trial, there are multiple possible remedies. Your remedy could have been severance, but you've not just forfeited, you've waived that in your appellate brief. Your evidence, sometimes people ask for separate juries. You never asked for that. What you're asking us for on appeal seems to be, you seem to be saying he should never have been allowed to represent himself. And yet I've never seen that as a remedy, and I'm not sure how that would be a Sixth Amendment remedy. So the remedy seems like it would have been sever the trial so that he could testify, et cetera. But I just don't understand how that's consistent with your affirmative waiver in giving that issue up on appeal.
I think the answer lies in the fact that there was a discussion about whether or not co-counsel was going to be obtained by Mr. Mano, so that the bulk of the trial could be handled by co-counsel rather than Mr. Mano. Mr. Mano at various times made promises to the court, one of which is that he was going to get co-counsel and proceed with co-counsel.
How would that have solved the problem that you're identifying? The problem you seem to have been identifying, and which may have been solved by a severance, is Mr. Mano can't forget the things he knows about Mr. Scarfo, things he may have learned in a confidential relationship. He can't, and he shouldn't, in fairness, be prevented from being able to question Mr. Scarfo about those things if they're relevant. And Mr. Scarfo shouldn't be subjected to that and have his prior counsel put in a conflicted position where those things might come into play. I mean, those are the arguments I think you're making. If Mr. Mano had had a lawyer between him and the court, how would that be any different? He would still know the things. He would still be able to say to his lawyer, ask him this or ask him that. How does representation make any difference?
I think we're focusing on that point, and I understand that. But the issue that I want to make sure that the court understands is that when Judge Kugler was confronted a clear conflict, he didn't do the proper inquiry, have a hearing, make findings to determine whether or not there truly was a conflict. If there truly was a conflict, the whole conversation would be different. There may very well have been a severance. Right. There may very well have been an assertion.
But you have a plain error problem in part because you didn't object in these terms. And so maybe he might have done things differently, but you didn't give him a contemporaneous objection. So we have to walk through the four-prong test for plain error. I want to hear you talk about why the error is plain or obvious. I want you to explain to me what the prejudice is. Are there privileged conversations or anything that he knew that got introduced? And I want you to talk about the fourth prong. Does it seriously affect the public reputation or fairness or integrity? Can you walk through those other prongs of the Olano test?
I'm going to make an attempt to do that.
Okay.
My point is this, is that Judge Kugler's obligation is to make sure the trial is run fairly, and if a conflict becomes clear to him, he has certain things he must do.
Well, first of all, explain why it was clear or obvious.
Well, I can read to you what he says in a year and a half prior to the trial, in which he talks about the question about client confidences. And Mano, even in that conversation, I can read you portions of it. The court's saying to Mano, you run the potential risk of revealing client confidences without permission of the client. Mano goes, well, there's no question on the second point with regard to client confidence. The detailed disclosures could conceivably do that. And then Kugler goes on to say, well, I'm not going to make a decision today, but I want you to understand there is a potential out there. There's a potential for statements that incriminate in a criminal case.
And did that happen?
What's that?
Is there anything you can point to in the record?
What did Mano say that prejudiced Mr. Scarpo? Yeah.
What did he say at the end of the trial? He called him a fraudster. He called him a liar. He said he was a mortgage fraud person, that he lied to probation, that he was he basically.
Were there any objections?
Can you point to any confidential communication that was revealed?
I think it's impossible to do that because Mano handled it in such a way you couldn't tell it was a communication or not. He was indicting his own client with his argument.
It wasn't his client. He was saying
client.
Bad things about a former client, and you might say, well, that's professionally distasteful. But can you point to any client confidential information that was used by Mr. Mano in any way during the course of the trial?
Mr. Mano had information that Mr. Scarfo had been involved in fraud. He knew that because he was participating in it. And that's one of the reasons he was indicted and why he went to trial. Okay? He was involved in this. It's clear. Judge Cooper was alerted to it. He was concerned. The failure in this entire process is we didn't have a hearing to explore this to determine whether there was a conflict, and if, in fact, there was conflict, that certain remedies occur.
Certain remedies would be?
One of them, after he has the conflict, he could have ordered a severance.
Okay.
We'll never know.
So you're arguing that he should sua sponte have done that, despite the fact that even in your brief there's no waiver.
That's a toughie.
There's no waiver of his obligation to do that. I mean, he had an obligation to do that when the conflict became clear to him. And clearly from the conversation in the roving room that I read portions of, he was concerned about it. He was concerned about it.
And of course, Mr. Scarfo never filed a motion for severance, right? All of this is an assertion that the judge should have known it on his own because Mr. Scarfo not only didn't object, never moved for severance, right?
Judge, doing it on his own, he knew about it. He was concerned about it.
But I'm taking it, the answer to my question is yes. Mr. Scarfo never moved
I'm sorry, he did not.
He joined Mano's severance motion,
yes.
But I believe he didn't use any words tying that. There was no connection to self-representation.
No. Judge Kugler had a ground rule set up where one party makes a motion,
but he never alerted the court to anything related to self-representation here. You're saying he had moved for it, Mano had it on different grounds, and that it should have been obvious.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Have you reserved your time for rebuttal, sir?
No, sir.
Okay. If you have something on rebuttal, we'll get you back in a couple of minutes anyway.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So, Mr. Gross, you prefer to do this issue by issue, is that correct?
Yes, that would be my preference.
Okay, you can take off your mask if you like.
Thank you. I think the court has highlighted the problems with this claim.
Give your name for the record.
Sorry. Assistant United States Attorney Norman Gross on behalf of the United States.
Thank you.
The only thing that Mr. Riley preserved in his opening brief was a claim that the district court plainly erred because it didn't sua sponte deny.
Can I just interrupt 1 second? How much time do you want for this particular portion? You want to do 36 in total for
sure.
This one?
No, not 36 for this argument. I think maybe okay. five minutes
okay,
for this one.
Maybe just do 5 for right now. Then we'll do 31 later.
Five right now?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We're going to be jumping back and forth on the clock, I think.
Thank you.
So Mr. Riley's claim in his opening brief was that Judge Kugler plainly erred because he did sua sponte deny Mr. Mano's request to proceed a motion that was not opposed by anybody. Had Judge Kugler denied that motion, he would have committed constitutional error because Mr. Mano had a constitutional right under Feretta versus California to represent himself.
Okay, but granted, there might be the ground shifting a little bit here, Mr. Gross, but can you address the argument the way Mr. Riley is framing it here at the podium today, which is it was plain error not to sever, even though Mr. Scarfo didn't make his own motion to sever. He may have tried to piggyback on Mr. Mano's motion, but he never made his own motion, and there was an affirmative waiver of it in the opening brief here. The way it's being framed to us now is plain error, this was a problem, there should have been a severance. That's how I'm hearing it. Maybe you heard it differently, but can you respond to the argument as it's being framed now, which is he knew it was going to risk client confidence, that Mr. Mano couldn't not know those client confidences, and it would put them in a by definition, a conflict situation, there should have been a severance. What's the response to that?
The response to that is that, really, I don't think this court can address that issue because it's not presented in the opening brief. This court is...
I got you. I understand that. That's why I'm asking you. I said, okay. I understand there's a waiver in the brief, so you could just leave that to the side and humor me. What's your answer on the merits?
We do that all the time with him, by the way.
Happy to do that. Hopefully, Judge, you'll humor me later on in this argument. But there's no plain error in failing to sever here. Jumping ahead a little bit to the severance argument that Mr. Huff is going to argue, severance is completely inappropriate here. There's several conspiracies charged in these indictments. There's a preference for joint trials of co-defendants in conspiracy cases.
And even when one of the co-defendants has previously represented another defendant, there's a lawyer-client relationship that could implicate, and the judge was concerned and voiced a concern that it would implicate client confidences.
Right, and so if Mr. Mano had said, which he did not, Judge, I'm going to testify, or I'm going to elicit testimony regarding confidences that my former client, Mr. Scarfo, has given to me.
But isn't the concern that before trial, there was Judge Kugler, a really good judge, realized there could be an issue here. This is treading on thin ice. And you might have thought that perhaps there would have been at least a limiting instruction, but there wasn't. I guess we're wondering why.
Well, there was no request for a limiting instruction, Judge. I mean, understand that Mr. Riley has done a 180 here in this court. At trial, the strategy was clear. You heard Mr. Riley get up here initially and talk about Mr. Mano's reputation as a very good, capable criminal defense attorney. And at the beginning of this case, Mr. Scarfo wanted Mr. Mano on the defense side in this case. He didn't want a severance. He wanted Mr. Mano as a co-defendant for two reasons. Number one, he and Palullo are the defendants against whom most of the testimony is going to come in. Most of the intercepted conversations involve them. There's overwhelming evidence because they're at the top of this food chain. And so it's always good, if you're the lead defendant, to have lots of other defendants sitting in the courtroom to divert the government's attention, force it to present evidence regarding those lesser defendants, and distract the jury from the evidence against you, the lead defendant. That's the tactical choice that the defense made in this case. And they got some of that. If you read Mr. Mano's closing argument, yes, he did on a couple of occasions say that Mr. Scarfo had committed obstruction of justice, but he, Mr. Mano, didn't know anything about it. But a lot of Mr. Mano's summation was a frontal assault to the prosecution, and parts of the summation also defended Mr. Scarfo and attacked the government for this indictment. So
sounds,
that was the
sounds
threat.
Sounds kind of messy, doesn't it?
Well, Mr. Scarfo is caught between a rock and a hard place. He doesn't have any good tactical choices here. But the choice that he made, and he now has to live with, is that he didn't move for severance. He joined Mr. Mano's severance in the vaguest possible way, in the sense that the judge said an objection as to one will be an objection as to all. But the claim that he's making now, the Sixth Amendment claim, that Mano could not represent himself in this case because it created a conflict, that was certainly never part of Mano's severance motion. Mano's severance motion had two parts. Judge, it's going to be a massive trial with too many defendants. Let's make it smaller. Let's cut it in half. And the other one was, I'm going to have to tell the jury that I represented Mr. Scarfo in some other criminal manners, and that's going to be detrimental to Mr. Scarfo. At that point, Judge Kugler turns to Mr. Riley and Mr. Gelb, two criminal defense attorneys with collectively about 60 years of experience, and says, well, that sounds like a problem for Mr. Scarfo. Inviting them, say, yeah, that's right, Judge, we don't like that. We think there should be a severance here. But what he heard? Crickets. So that was a waiver of the severance motion in the district court. You've got a waiver in the opening brief. And simply put, this claim can't get off the ground. Judge Kugler did several times say to Mr. Mano, you know, you may run into problems with the rules of professional conduct here if you represent yourself, because Scarfo's your prior client. But
how does it matter whether there's a lawyer representing him or he's self-representing
him? It absolutely doesn't, Judge. As you pointed out, nothing that Mano said on his own behalf couldn't have been said by another lawyer representing him.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. All right.
Well, we can hear back from Mr. Archie, and we'll get you back.
Thank you.
For the, I guess, the next issues are 3, 5, 6, and 7. Is that correct, Mr. Archie?
Yes. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. While you're coming, do you wish to reserve any time?
I do, Judge. I would request 10 minutes reservation for rebuttal.
Fine. That's fine. So set 24, if you would, please.
The first issue is whether threats to sue can count as extortion, Palullo, Maxwell, and John Maxwell.
You said 10 minutes for rebuttal, excuse me.
Right? 10, yes.
10, 26, I'm sorry, 26. Yeah, my fault, I said 20, I think I said 24.
So issue 3 is whether threats to sue can count as extortion, Palullo, William Maxwell, and John Maxwell. Yes and no. If we look at the Michael Avenatti case up in the second district, where you're suing someone for your client, but then you're making threats that have absolutely nothing to do with the case. That's extortion in a business context, but not in this case. Just to put a little flesh on Mr. Palullo, I've had the pleasure of representing him for 10 years. He's been incarcerated all 10 years. Prior to him going down to Texas with this alleged threat, he had just sold a company for $8 million, north of $8 million. He owned a 12,000-square-foot house in Pennsylvania. He owned a shore house in New Jersey. He owned a penthouse in Miami. He had a Ferrari. He was not some street thug from South Philadelphia. He was a businessman. He may have talked tough, the tough Tony talk, but he's very bright. He was a businessman.
You're dealing with issue 3?
3, yes.
Is that correct? Did the investigation give rise to a Sixth Amendment violation? Is that correct?
I think.
It's whether we were talking about the extortion issue? That's question 5.
Did I go out of order?
You can talk whatever order you want. That's
you
fine.
You want to start with that, that's
I'm
fine.
Just curious about if you're talking about the extortion issue, you were saying, well, yeah, Avenatti, an example of threats unrelated to the case. There was testimony in here about, you know, allegations that he raped his secretary and gotten her pregnant and then paid her hush money.
Well, now,
that sounds unrelated to the subject of the corporate takeover.
Judge, I have the letter here, if I could pass it up to the court.
Okay, now, I've reviewed the letter, and the letter itself makes a general reference to some problems in which you've deceived your wife. But then that gets coupled with testimony, and the testimony was more specific about allegations that rape were involved. And the jury, we have to view this in the light the jury could reasonably have found, that the allegations, this was stirring up a bunch of things that were not about mismanagement of the corporation, but about just generic wrongdoing being given to the divorce lawyer.
Judge, I don't think Mr. Phillips testified, or Mr. Freeman, who were board members. Maybe Mr. Roberts, who had nothing to do with the board.
Was it Jack Rubinick? I think, but there was testimony from about the rape. I was just looking at it half an hour ago.
Judge, I would ask the court to review the trial record. Daniel Phillips, who was a board member, and Mr. Freeman, who was also a board member, they both testified, no threats from Mr. Palullo. They didn't know he was connected to any alleged LCN. They never even heard of Nick Scarfo, so the LCN had nothing to do with it.
Right.
They met these guys in like a war room at a hotel. They was doing their little data to make, you know, actually take over the company.
Well, leave for the side for a moment the sort of scurrilous charge that we're going to tell your wife's divorce lawyer you raped your secretary. Put that to the side. And talk to us about the assertions that they made that we're going to get federal authorities in here to investigate Sarbanes-Oxley violations because there are violations, and we're going to get the feds to put you under a microscope. Now, why don't we take one step back from that? Do you agree that threats of economic harm can be extortionate threats? It's not just physical threats that can be extortionate threats.
It can be if it's property you're not entitled to. This was a public company. Anybody's entitled to a public company, even the shareholders.
So no matter what they said to him, no matter what they said to the board to put instill fear in them would be okay because your position is, as a publicly traded stock, nobody was entitled to it. It's just on the open market. Did I understand that correctly?
I implore this court to read the transcripts. The people talking about the threats and being scared had nothing to do with the board takeover. The board members...
Roberts is the one who testified to that.
Yeah, Roberts had nothing to do with... He was the person who bought the deal to Mr. Palullo. Okay. He had nothing to do with the four board members who met with a lawyer, vetted the whole situation. Mr. Phillips even testified and said, yes, I cheated on my wife. Yes, it was somebody at First Plus. Then he talked about this whole issue that he had where former President Dan Quayle, investigated... First Plus for previous actions.
Mr. Archie, are you saying that there's no testimony in the record where people said this could destroy reputation?
There's no testimony from the people who could turn over the board.
Okay. Yeah. Well, but there is record testimony. We have to look at the record as a whole in the light most favorable to the government. But stick with me on the question I might be inartfully trying to ask you, which is, if it's true that economic threats can be extortionate, and if it's true that there were threats being made to the officers and board that we will report you as violating federal regulations and submit you to attack in front of regulators and publicly as violating the law, what is it in the law that makes that outside the realm of potentially actionable extortion?
Well, Judge, I think, one, it has to be private property, not public property. And two, this was not a situation where they even took up this threat of the FBI and all that. They were concerned, if you read their testimony, they were concerned with Sarbanes-Oxley violations, which when this new board came in, they did hire a company to straighten it out, and they were they were worried about defending a lawsuit if they had to go in their own pockets to pay for it.
Well, weren't there, isn't there evidence in the record that they cooked this up? They knew it was false, that these Sarbanes-Oxley things were, that was a complete canard, that it was developed as a way to scare these businessmen into thinking, we'll ruin your reputation and we'll ruin you financially because we will get federal authorities to steamroll you. That's the way it's presented by the government. And I guess the real the only question we've got to deal with is there record evidence that supports that assertion? If you accept that economic threats can be extortion, is there evidence here that they did that?
Respectfully, Judge, I think the person who testified about it was Mr. Roberts, who actually got money out of the deal, was a cooperating witness, and was not prosecuted.
So the jury had in its prerogative to disbelieve Roberts. But when Roberts testifies about rape and Roberts testifies about it, the economic threats and everything else, and the jury convicts, but we have to find that the jury thought those credibility problems were not fatal and they believed him.
But the actual people who received the threat testify. It's right in it. They said they were not threatened.
Let's assume you're right. Let's assume this is completely legally flawed. We got six or seven other RICO predicates. Why should we even care?
Because
you only need three RICO predicates.
Respectfully, Judge, the entire case started with the extortion. If you take away the extortion, this is a garden variety fraud case.
Well, you got mail fraud, wire fraud, bank fraud, obstruction of justice, extortion, interstate travel and aid of racketeering, money laundering, and fraud.
The RICO conviction stands if you knock that out.
Well, Judge, respectfully, Judge, if you look at the extortion, which was based on the LCN, which the LCN didn't come up until months down the road, if you take that away, it's a garden variety fraud case. You had the other lawyers in this case who got a limiting instruction every time some extortionate type of testimony came out saying they had nothing to do with the LCN, so you can't count this evidence against
right,
them.
Right, but just please focus in on what Judge Bibas is asking you. Assume we took the extortionate threat out and I agreed with you. There's still convictions on
seven other counts.
There's statements
six for Maxwell,
that the jury found those other several predicate offenses. Those are all independent findings, aren't they?
Yeah, but the extortion is tied into the LCN. If you look at the RICO statute,
you're not sticking with me. Stick with me, Mr. Archie. Those other things, am I correct that the jury made findings with respect to those predicate acts?
Yeah, I would agree with that, Judge.
Okay, and if you only need, for pattern or practice, you need just a couple of additional ones, then there's enough. You take the extortion out, there's still enough predicates to sustain a RICO conviction, isn't there?
No, because the LCN is tied to extortion. If you look at the RICO, it's extortion, murder, and other things like that, kidnapping. The other wire fraud and all that, that's garden variety stuff underneath the extortion statute. Without the LCN extortion, how do you get an LCN RICO for wire fraud?
So the assertion is it just doesn't make it because under what, 1963, this is not one of the, it's not one of the crimes that RICO would cover.
Correct, Judge.
Okay. I apologize. I understand.
Okay. Maybe we could, our time's limited, but I do want to make sure I hear about question seven, which is the joint and several liability issue. That's one of the ones you're talking
Judge,
about.
I think that's an easy one, Judge.
So let's talk about Honeycutt a little bit. First of all, the facts in Honeycutt were about, you know, this low-level guy at a hardware store, and the hypo the court uses involves like a college student who's just like a low-level dealer. But
right,
the contrasts the low-level deal with the mastermind, right? So the first question is, isn't Palullo more like a mastermind if he's at least indirectly receiving the proceeds? Because if the jury credits that, in fact, he's the judge credits that, in fact, he's running the show and the company's getting all this, why isn't his situation different from the one that Honeycutt was dealing with? And after that, I want to talk about the
plainer effect. I don't think Honeycutt made a bright-line rule that says if you're a leader or organizer,
that ties into my second problem, which is you didn't object to this below. You did not preserve this error.
Well, I don't think Honeycutt was out at that time.
Okay, it wasn't. Right. We're on appeal. We measure the plainness there at the time of appeal. Fair point. But you, if it's an error, how is it a plain error if Honeycutt didn't make a bright line rule?
Judge, it's a plain error because you have individuals, there's 14 million, 12 million, whatever the number is.
Right.
And Mr. Pullo did not touch all that money. We made other arguments regarding forfeiture and actual restitution that I think ties into Honeycutt with loss amounts.
So, you made some arguments. You right. got some arguments. The closest I've seen, the Supreme Court, the D.C. Circuit had this case, Leyva, right? It was a higher-level guy held liable for a whole amount of restitution, and they said he didn't make the objection either. It's not plain to us that Honeycutt reaches the guy at the top, right? We know Honeycutt lets the lower-level guy off, but you said there was no bright-line rule. If there's an error, how's the error plain if, as you said, there's no bright-line rule?
Well, Judge, there's a Third Circuit case. I can't pronounce
Jelly?
It. Jelly.
Jelly extended Honeycutt to this statute, but Jelly didn't say even masterminds are covered by this.
Well, we're asking that it be for, Judge. I think this may be something that would go up the chain eventually.
Maybe it's an error, but I think you got a problem on plain. Anyway.
It seems like this could be an argument maybe for John Maxwell, but
well, I think no they joined in as well. I think the government conceded as to John Maxwell, okay. Actually.
Yeah. Let's say there's an error. Let's say it's plain. Let's say he's prejudiced, all right? Talk to me about the fourth prong of Olano. How does it look bad to the public, affect the public integrity, the public reputation or integrity of the proceedings to hold a high-level guy like Pullo responsible for the whole amount? How is that going to call the justice system into question if we let this stand?
Well, Judge, if you look at the fact that the entire amount is in dispute in itself, there was a forfeiture order for $14 million. We said it was way less than that. And then you also have people who contributed that reduced this amount throughout the years.
Well, wait. I'm sorry. When you say people who contributed who reduced this amount.
So that some of the acquitted defendants paid several million dollars in restitution to the bankruptcy court. We didn't get credit for that. Other people paid. We didn't get credit for that. We just got the blanket 14.
Well, that's the order, and then you compute it against the total amount, Roy Jordan several works. So ultimately, you don't wind up paying more than the amount minus what other people
paid. Well, so if you put Honeycutt and then you consider the amount that people paid, the law has changed, I think we at least should get a remand, and the judge should be ordered to figure this out. Because at this point, it just stays that Mr. Pullo is required to pay $14 million or forfeit $14 million. Well, we know sitting here what the Third Circuit said it agrees with Honeycutt.
I thought that you would just go to the, you know, when you pay this money in, you know, the probation officers or whoever do the computations here, and you say, okay, the judgment was for this amount, but this part of the judgment isn't satisfied. Why is that something that requires a separate order from the district court?
I mean, it gets into our whole argument, and you'll see it when you read the full brief. We had a whole big issue with probation in itself because it just relied on the government's calculations and didn't do its own independent fact-finding. So we challenged the four, not on the Honeycutt aspect, but we challenged it in other areas. So I would rely on our brief and say Mr. Pullo at least requires a remand on that issue.
You got issues. You got two other issues. Which of the two do you want to start with?
Can I ask one further question? Because I'm not sure that I understood the last thing you said, Mr. Archie. When you said we'd rely on a brief on that issue, that issue that you're talking about, your Honeycutt issue seemed to bleed over into some broader argument about, hey, it was calculated wrong, and the judge didn't do what the judge should have done.
Absolutely.
So when you're relying on your brief, am I understanding you correctly to say that your primary concern with Honeycutt, the Honeycutt issue, is that the judge didn't do his own work?
Right. I don't think the judge did his own work. I don't think U.S. probation did their own work. They relied on the government's representation as to the loss amount. And if you put Honeycutt versus those other portions that we argue, I think you'll see my argument.
I thought you were suggesting that they needed to go back and recalculate the amount each time these payments were made. And I don't think that that's normally done by the sentencing judge, the crediting of amounts other people have paid.
Well, I think if Your Honor sent it back under Honeycutt, we would be entitled to a recalculation. And there's been multiple payments. There was payments made when sentencing was made.
So your main concern, I'm just trying to make sure, because, and don't worry, we've seen your briefs. We've seen lots of briefs in this case.
Right.
Lots of long briefs. But things sometimes shift at the podium.
Right.
Your chief concern is there's double counting going on here. The government's going to potentially forfeit more than the amount because they're going to try to get all $14 million from Mr. Puello when they've actually already gotten the equivalent of a forfeiture in the way of restitution from other people.
I'll try to frame it and end it with this. We're relying on Honeycutt. We think that only each individual co-conspirator should actually be the money attributed that went through their hands, through their pockets, through their bank accounts, that should count towards them. And also, if you look at our other portions, the loss amount or forfeiture amount of $14 million, we think it was calculated wrong. So it was much less than where it's at now. And then Honeycutt.
Is restitution different from forfeiture?
Well, it can be. I mean, in this case, it's literally one and the same because they're saying that it's the same number. But yeah, forfeiture, I think, is a different avenue. Restitution could be, well, Honeycutt's not saying joint and several, but I understand a restitution order says that everybody has to pay in. I'm saying under Honeycutt, you have to only count the amount that went in Mr. Palullo's pocket.
All right, I got you. Thanks.
Of the two remaining issues, issue three and issue, I guess, six.
So issue three would be Mr. Farrell.
Right.
Right.
You claim that Mr. Farrell had a conflict.
Well, I think everyone agreed that Mr. Farrell had a conflict. The question becomes, was it an actual conflict? Mr. Farrell didn't tell anybody. He didn't tell me. He didn't tell Mr. Puello. He didn't tell the government. And quite honestly, his track record during the trial, after he found out that he was under investigation, I mean, it was a big one. I mean,
let me ask you about that, okay? Right. The thrust of your brief is this guy was just crazy aggressive.
Right.
He has a 13-and-a-half-hour closing that's rambling. He's like getting on the judge's nerves. He's attacking. That's what your brief was emphasizing. But you got the problem that there's a letter from your client to the district court saying, Mr. Archie's been a fine lawyer, but I want to relieve Mr. Archie from representing me at sentencing. I like Mr. Farrell's aggressive style. So how can you say your client embraced that aggressive style? Even though your style, we're not going to talk, maybe it's more effective, whatever, but it's his choice as to which kind of art or approach he wants. And if he said he wanted that to the trial court, how can we find it ineffective?
Well, I think that letter came towards sentencing, not actually trial purposes. Mr. Farrell he messed up names. He messed up exhibits.
But your client heard all that. After all that,
My client was kicking me under the table the whole time. So a lot of times I had to jump up and help Mr. Farrell when I had piles of stuff that I had to do coming up next.
Well, and you may very well have had bruised ankles in the course of a six-month trial, but it's a six-month trial. People in a complex case, things are going to go a little bit haywire for everybody. But here's the thing that is intriguing to me. He's aggressive throughout. There doesn't appear to be a change in his demeanor or his style. He's an aggressive guy at the start. He's an aggressive guy in the middle. He's an aggressive guy at the end. And Mr. Palullo doesn't seem to have a problem with that. He actually seems to like it. So if he's the same Mr. Farrell throughout, and Mr. Palullo's been able to see it throughout, how are we to read into the record oh, this is a consequence of something that happened midway.
Right. Well, I think I don't think you can read into the record. The issue is Mr. Farrell is always aggressive, yes, but I don't think Mr. Pulo wanted him to be aggressive and mess up the case with wrong names, wrong exhibits, putting the jury to sleep, screaming at the jury, arguing with the judge nonstop.
But he was doing some of those things. I mean, there's some headbutting going on with the district court before any of this comes to light, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, again, if we can't look at this record and we're looking at it in the light most favorable to the government, how can we look at it and say, well, that's what happened? There
well,
was
Mr.
a
Farrell,
conflict that developed and it changed the man's behavior. During, it doesn't look like it changed it.
And during the remand, Mr. Farrell, he testified that it affected him. That he did, so I don't know what more you can do if the actual defense attorney gets on the stand and says, look, I didn't have my stuff together. I didn't have my client's best interest at heart.
What evidence do you have besides that testimony that his performance at trial was affected by the District of Maryland's investigation of him?
Well, Judge, the court remanded the matter. We had all this litigation.
Right.
And then the DOJ brought these charges against
But what evidence do you have?
Well, we don't have all the evidence because we were cut off. Judge Kugler did not allow us to find out if the DOJ actually put somebody on notice. And that's what...
But the U.S. Attorney's Office, in this case, I thought they testified that they did not know about the Maryland investigation.
Well, yes, New Jersey testified. The unfortunate problem we have here, Your Honors, is that two of the U.S. attorneys that can answer the questions are no longer here. AUSA Diaguano's not here, and AUSA Johnson, who prosecuted Mr. Farrell, is not here.
But isn't there a record made in front of Judge Kugler where the District of Maryland people say, we didn't tell them, and the District of New Jersey people say, we didn't know anything about it?
Right.
So you got it from both ends. Maryland says, we didn't tell them. New Jersey says, we didn't know anything about it. There doesn't appear to be any basis to say, unless what your assertion is just don't believe the government.
No, my assertion is that when an attorney is prosecuted for money laundering like Mr. Farrell, the Department of Justice has to give the green light. There has to be some kind of conversation, some kind of memo. We had a Department of Justice representative on our trial team, Ms. Johnston, God rest her soul. She's a former U.S. attorney from Maine Justice. We were trying to see if there was a memo that came because that would prove actual conflict. If somebody in New Jersey knew, if there was a memo floating around from Maine Justice, then we prove our case, Mr. Pulo gets a new trial. We get cut off when it gets close to that part.
Well, okay, you say you get cut off. It seemed that the judge gave ample opportunity to develop a record, and there was no record to be developed. There was no sworn testimony from both sides of the communication you say is happening that there. But I think I understand your argument.
Okay. For the last issue, the one dealing with the CAFRA thing, do you want to just wait for rebuttal to deal with that?
Yes.
That'd be fine. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Keller?
May it please the court, I'm Bruce Keller, also representing the United States, and I'm here to discuss the issue of extortion.
And you had reserved 10 minutes, is that right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You reserved 10 minutes, is that correct?
He's
got 10 minutes.
I'm sorry. That's what I meant. They gave us the notice before. It's 50 for Mr. Gross and 10 for you.
15 minutes overall. I have two issues, so I thought I'd spend 11 minutes on extortion, if you'll let me. And I'd like to start I think the best way to get into it is to give my answer to your question, Judge Bibas, and your question, Judge Jordan, because, Judge Bibas, you connected the dots between the Draper letter and the testimony about the rape, extortion, pregnancy, and payoff allegations, and they are in the record at the appendix at 1821 to 24 from Mr. Roberts, who worked with the defendants. And there is a connection between those letters because those letters were written carefully. The testimony is that Mr. Pulo was actually dictating them, and their phrases are carefully chosen. Judge Jordan, you asked the question, can you say anything to a public company, and even when it smears a reputation and get away with it? The answer to that is no, but the testimony, I think that's most relevant on that point, because Mr. Archie was harping on the members of the board who were in a position to give up the company, is from Mr. Friedman, and his testimony at 9778-1 makes clear that they feared for their reputations, they decided it wasn't worth it, they thought they'd have to pay for their own attorney, and they decided to, as the old commercial for cigarettes used to say, they decided to switch and not fight. It wasn't worth it. That's extortion. Why is it extortion? It's extortion because the plain language of 1951 creates no safe harbor for any particular threat whatsoever, whether it's whistleblowing.
Okay. Well, Mr. Keller, let's stop for a moment and ask this. For the sake of argument, is Mr. Archie right that if the extortion predicate is out, then RICO is out altogether? It doesn't matter. It make any difference how many other predicates you have, because extortion is the only thing that ties this into RICO.
So that's clearly not right, and the plain language of the RICO statute makes that clear. And because I thought you might hear something like that, let me point out what United States against Turquette said about that, because in Turquette, the Supreme Court quoted from the legislative history extensively about RICO, and the Senate and the Congress's overriding concern, and this is at 452 U.S. 588, was the pervasiveness of the problem that led RICO to include a wide range of predicate acts. And it was in order, it was done to forestall exactly what we've got here, the use of leverage to infiltrate and corrupt legitimate businesses. And you made the point, I think both of you did, that there are any number of predicate acts to which there is no challenge. You could disagree with us on extortion, and the RICO predicates still stand as a matter of law.
Okay, while we're on extortion, what do you think would be the test for determining when a threat of civil litigation it equals extortion?
So let me just step back and say the threats here were not just of civil litigation. They went way beyond that.
There was a Sarbanes-Oxley.
Well, there were Sarbanes-Oxleys. There was a threat of going to law enforcement. But there was also the threat of going to the media. It's right there in the letters. And Mr. Friedman talked about that, too. And it is extortion when you threaten to disclose salacious and, in this case, provably untrue allegations about somebody in order to get them part with their property. And the test, Your Honor, was articulated by this court in both U.S. against Tobin and Brokerage Concepts. Because there is no safe harbor for any particular type of threat, the test is, did the victim, and there are many victims here, have a pre-existing right to be free from the particular threat used to get them to give up their property? That's Tobin at 155 F3rd, 640 to 641, and it's Brokerage Concepts at 140 F3rd, 525 to 526. But more importantly, I think, is the case on which they rely in the reply brief, Koziel. It's a recent Ninth Circuit case. There, the extortion was committed by threats of sexual misconduct, which were plainly unfounded.
Okay.
And the Ninth Circuit...
We are limited on time, so I want you to circle back and finish answering the question I tried to articulate, and that is, if I understand Mr. Archie's argument, he's not saying that those other things can't stand as predicate acts for a RICO conviction. I understand his assertion to be that the RICO statute itself only outlaws things that are related to one of the things named in the statute, murder, extortion, etc. And if you take out the extortion here, then you don't have anything to tie all those other predicate acts together to and call it RICO. Now, maybe I misunderstood him, but I understood that to be the legal point he was making. Do you have a response to that, the assertion that without extortion, you might have a bunch of illegal stuff, but they don't constitute, no matter how many of them you have, they don't constitute a pattern and practice of racketeering activity of the sort that's outlawed by RICO, which gets at murder, extortion, that, et cetera.
It's just wrong, and it's wrong because of the plain language of the RICO statute and the way that it was structured, and that's why I started with Turquette. And all the and the Jaguar Motor Cars case, which Judge Becker wrote for this court, goes through By the way, there's also a difference drawn in some of the cases between civil RICO and criminal RICO. But this is criminal RICO at the heart of what Congress was trying to stop. They didn't want any of the predicate acts used to acquire, infiltrate legitimate companies. And in terms of the pattern, we all know the pattern is two or more. And we have here up to half a dozen other predicate acts for which the government proved the case that constitute predicate acts they're not even challenging. So throw extortion out. The answer isn't you don't have RICO anymore. You just look at the other predicate acts that we proved, that we alleged in the indictment, and that we put on evidence, and that the jury concluded the evidence showed were committed. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
It does. Thank you.
So I think I ended with Koziol, and the reason I think it's important to take a look at, even though they cited, it was decided after our brief, right around the time of theirs, April of 2021, allegations of sexual misconduct, clearly unfounded, and the Ninth Circuit went through an excruciating analysis of when threats of any kind, including threats of litigation, which is not just what we have here, but threats to file a lawsuit, along with other things, can constitute extortion. And in so doing, they cite with approval this court's U.S. against Tobin decision, and they contrast U.S. against Pendergraft and other sorts of cases, and they point out that the Pendergraft line of cases are wrong. Why? Because they're not based on plain text of the statute. They're based on policy decisions. And the Ninth Circuit's response to that, I think, applies here. Some lawsuits are worth chilling. The threats of lawsuit and the other acts here are clearly worth chilling because they were predicate acts of RICO. So I urge that to the court.
What's your response? You started to answer this earlier, but what's your response to the assertion that you can't extort something that another person doesn't have a right to themselves? That this is an open market, freely traded stock. So it wasn't the board's property. It's the public markets. Nobody's got a right to it except the individuals who own perhaps a specific share. What's the answer to that?
So I think there I'd like to start with what the record shows about how this plot unfolded. It started with a possibly lawful acquisition of First Plus. Had the defendants been able to acquire the money they needed to buy the stock to launch a lawful, although hostile, takeover, we wouldn't be here today. That's not what they did. When Mr. Draper dropped in their lap, they took advantage of the allegations that he was peddling, and they used them to threaten the board members to give up control of the company, clearly a transferable asset. In that process, they also acquired shares of the company, and they also acquired the money, the income stream, the waterfall stream that the company had a possessory interest in. And they took all of that, and they looted the company and used it to their own ends. So I don't understand how there's any thing that could carry over this issue. They acquired a public company. One of their witnesses, their own witness, marveled aloud that that could happen. How does one acquire a public company through those sorts of allegations? And the answer is he really didn't know the full detail of everything that Mr. Pelullo used. And on that note, let me just point out that Mr. Pelullo himself was heard by the jury bragging about giving Mr. Phillips and the rest of the board 18 hours to surrender, the word surrender, 18 hours to surrender the company. You don't get to walk into a meeting with a public company board and demand that they give up the company in 18 hours unless you're instilling fear that would cause them to part with those assets. And that's classic blackmail. That's classic extortion.
Can we ask some honeycut questions here?
Well, I want you to add three more minutes, honeycut, please.
I am not Mr. Honeycutt.
Oh, he's not. Mr. Gross is not a guy.
My bad. Thanks.
No.
I'll be back.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Can't tell the players without a program.
A lot of issues here, and I thank the court for narrowing them down a little bit for the argument. You heard Mr. Archie devote a lot of his argument to complaints about contributions that other individuals made to the court. That's not a preserved claim. In fact, the whole thing, none of this Honeycutt stuff would have been preserved because when the government handed up the proposed joint and several liability forfeiture order to Judge Kugler at the end of the case, Judge Kugler turned to Mr. Archie and said, any objection? And Mr. Archie said, no.
Okay.
That's a waiver. But
that's not a waiver.
That's not ordinarily a waiver just to say no.
Right. But it's certainly plain error.
All right. So we're on plain error. The law changes. Under Henderson, we look at the law as of the time of appeal.
And that's why the Honeycutt issue is in play.
Right.
But certainly these other complaints about the amount mm-hmm. of the forfeiture is too high because there's been contributions to the court right. from some other unnamed people in other unnamed amounts that caused that forfeiture amount to be wrong. That we're hearing for the first time here.
Okay.
And that's too late.
So let's talk about Honeycutt then.
Sure. So Honeycutt said, it looked at 21 U.S.C. 853, it looked closely at the text of the statute and said, you joint and several liability doesn't apply here. Only thing that can be forfeited is tainted property, mm-hmm. and it can only be forfeited from somebody who gets that property or controls it. And here, Mr. Honeycutt, he's merely the manager of the hardware store that's selling the iodine that's being used to make the meth. He's not in control. He's a middle guy. Mm-hmm. The guy that's in control is the owner of the store, the guy at the top. Who's at the top of this conspiracy? Mr. Palullo is absolutely, with Mr. Scarfo, at the top of this conspiracy. They're calling all the shots.
Well, hold on a second. Did the Supreme Court say, I mean, you're asking us to make a step, aren't you, Mr. Gross? In Honeycutt, the Supreme Court said just what you said a moment ago, which is Mr. Honeycutt managed the store, but his brother owned the store. Mr. Honeycutt himself is only going to be liable, the manager, for the stuff that flowed to him. They didn't take the next step and say, but the brother will be liable for everything, did they?
No, but as Judge Bibas pointed out, to take that next step, you have to go beyond Honeycutt. And that's something that can't be plainly erroneous.
Right,
at this
so
point.
Now we're not talking about whether it's error. Maybe it's error, but your point is it's not at the second step of Olano, it's not plain.
That's right. And
now, Honeycutt talks about a mastermind, but it's all in a marijuana hypo context. The actual facts, the court did not come out and say, well, of course, Honeycutt's brother is fully liable, and that's his point.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a plainness issue. You can't dispute that there's prejudice here if he's, like, held liable for more rather than less. So you have an argument on point two. You have an argument on point four of Olano about
sure.
affecting substantial rights.
Sure.
I mean, fairness, integrity, public reputation of the proceedings.
Yes. There's a twofold response to that. First of all, Mr. Palullo owes $14 million in restitution personally, not jointly and severally, although the government, the victims are only entitled to collect $14
million. How do those things relate?
Because
the government can't say, give us $14 million in restitution, and then say, now give us $14 million in forfeiture.
We can.
Or can they?
We can, Your Honor. The cases are unanimous on that. Those are separate things. It sounds unfair. But restitution has to do with loss, the loss of the victims. And it's a completely separate form of liability than forfeiture. Forfeiture has to do with the gain of the defendant. And here, Palullo took $14 million away from the victim. The forfeiture amount was somewhat less. It was $12 million. But that was the gain to Mr. Palullo in the sense that he controlled $12 million of the shareholders' assets.
So restitution position is those things, they're just separate. So he can get hammered for them twice.
Yes.
And does that also mean that whatever restitutionary amounts other people paid has nothing to do with what he owes under forfeiture or restitution? Is that your position?
The position is that restitution has to be paid first. So any payments that any of these defendants or acquitted people are making to the court are going to have to go to pay off restitution. Okay. And until we get that $14 million of restitution paid, Mr. Pelullo is not going to pay any money towards forfeiture. So if we're looking at prong four, which is a miscarriage of justice, the chance that Mr. Pelullo is ever going to pay a nickel of this forfeiture amount is effectively zero. And so the court, the justice system, is not going to be held up to ridicule if it doesn't say, oh, we've got a honeycut violation here, Mr. Pelullo is going to suffer real harm in his pocketbook, and the judicial system and fairness is going to be...
So the restitution amount's $14 million, the forfeiture's $12 million, we're in ballpark, right?
That's right.
And so if restitution gets satisfied first, then there will be nothing left to forfeit by the time he's paid the restitution.
No, that's not true. Once he's satisfied the restitution payments, right, he is still obligated to pay that forfeiture amount.
Yeah, but your assertion is, maybe it's in the question the way it was framed, nothing left. You're saying as a practical matter, it can't be an Olano prong four problem because Mr. Pelullo's he's going to have no assets, period, so don't worry about it. That's the allegation the government is making.
With respect to the fourth prong, that's right.
Yeah. Is there such a thing as double counting and forfeiture, even if we're not worried about joint and several liability? Just run a hypothetical with me. Is it or is it not the case that the government's only entitled to forfeit the value once, right? You can't get more than 100% of that $14 million forfeiture, right?
If Mr. Drosner had come along and ponied up $12 million in forfeiture, Mr. Pelullo would not own anything.
Okay, so how is that accounted for at all in the way this judgment order is set forth, or is that something we need to be worried about? Because Mr. Archie's argument to us is people are paying stuff in now. He's talking restitution, or maybe he's talking forfeiture. I don't know, but let's assume that he's right, that there's some forfeiture money that's come in. How would we know that? Did the judge account for that? Is that a problem in the judgment commitment order?
Judge Jordan, we don't know that because there's no record on that. Because this was what I was trying to get at. Mr. Archie did not object to the forfeiture amount. I would argue that is a waiver. But regardless, he didn't raise any objection to forfeiture. And so Honeycutt may have enabled him to raise on plain error this new claim that it was just recognized by the Supreme Court after the forfeiture proceedings. But all of this other stuff about other people putting money into the court, that there's simply nothing in the record. Mr. Archie, he's an honorable person, and I don't believe that he's misinforming the court, but there's nothing for the court to look at this point because there hasn't been an objection, there hasn't been a motion filed with the district court saying, or with the probation office saying, can we have an accounting of the monies that have been submitted so far so we can keep track of how much money is still owed for restitution? That just hasn't been done. And so that issue is not before you.
All right.
I'd like to turn to the Farrell issue, if I could. And Mr. Archie started his argument off with a statement that no one disputes that there's a conflict. I'm not sure that that's undisputed. The question is, was there a conflict during the trial? Because during the trial, all that Mr. Farrell knew is that his office manager had received a grand jury subpoena. He went to Mr. Fioravanti, a very experienced criminal defense attorney, and he said, do I have to disclose this information? And Mr. Fioravanti calls up Ms. Johnson, says, is my client a target? And she says, I can't tell you. Fioravanti goes back to Farrell and says, you don't know that you're a subject or target? I don't think you have to say anything. Now, clearly, there's a conflict after the trial when Ms. Johnson writes to Mr. Fioravanti and says, here's a target letter. That certainly creates a conflict of interest. But what we're looking at here is a conflict that affected Mr. Farrell's performance during the trial.
If you had known during the trial that Mr. Farrell was under investigation in the District of Maryland, what would you have done?
I would have brought that to the attention of Judge Kugler as a prophylactic measure.
Was it incumbent on Mr. Farrell to do the same thing, even if he had a good lawyer tell him, technically I don't think you've got a conflict at this point. Was it incumbent upon him to go to his own client and to the court and say, there's investigation of money laundering going on? And certainly Mr. Farrell, one would think he might have some awareness of being at risk if his secretary is the one getting called in front of the grand jury. Was it incumbent upon him to do something to let the court and let his client know?
I will say this, Judge Jordan, I think it certainly would have been the better practice for him to do that. I'm not sure that he had a legal obligation to do it, but let's assume that he did. Let's assume that he did, and he didn't. Then the question becomes, what kind of conflict do we have? Because that really determines what the various burdens are here. And if it's an actual conflict, meaning Farrell's interests are now diverged from his client's interest, from Palullo's interest, that's an actual conflict of interest. And there, the defendant has to show a substantial impairment of the attorney's performance. But there can't be an actual conflict here because there is no divergence. Mr. Palullo wants to be acquitted. Mr. Farrell is doing everything that, by his lights, he can do to get Mr. Palullo acquitted. This isn't a situation where it's a classic actual conflict case. This is this court's decision in Zepp, where during the trial, it turns out that the defense attorney may be liable for possession of the drugs in the house. He and the client are in the house together, the toilet's flushed, and the attorney forces his client to stipulate that the attorney didn't flush the drugs down the toilet. Well, that's an actual conflict because it's in the personal interest of the attorney not to be charged for this crime. That situation is totally absent here.
Okay. And I don't hear the assertion to the contrary from the other side. What I do hear coming from the other side is that this clearly affected Mr. Farrell's capacity to perform adequately on behalf of his client, and that Mr. Farrell himself acknowledged as much in front of Judge Kugler, said, it did affect, and I wasn't able to do my job. What are we to do with that record?
This court should completely and utterly disregard Farrell's false testimony that he was overly aggressive at trial because of the subpoena that was issued to his office manager. Judge Kugler said, I don't credit any of that testimony. I sit here in the courtroom with Mr. Farrell for 2 days, and Judge Kugler heard his testimony. He heard my explanations as why Mr. Farrell's testimony was perjured and false, and he said he didn't believe Farrell's claim that this subpoena affected him at all. And so that's simply not a fact that this court can consider. It's been discredited by the fact finder, and when it's discredited by the fact finder, and for good reason, Farrell's a convicted obstructor of justice. He is someone who lied to Judge Simandl in another case. He lied to Judge Kugler about something else in this case. He contradicted his own attorney, Mr. Bergstrom, on a key issue. There's 12 ways to Sunday why Judge Kugler could reasonably conclude that Farrell was lying and that because Farrell hated the government so much, he was going to come into court in those remand proceedings, fall on his sword, and say, oh, I did a terrible job. It's all because of the subpoena. My client deserves a new trial. Mr. Farrell is still on Team Palullo during the remand hearing. That's how you know that there isn't any divergence of interests here, and that's why it can't be an actual conflict. So then what do you do?
You're just saying, am I understanding right, like on the standard of review, Judge Kugler, you could say is certainly not clearly erroneous in his finding, and that's game over for it affected his performance.
Correct.
All right, fine.
So then where do we go? That means if there is a potential conflict, then Palullo has to satisfy the Strickland standard. And all we've heard in the briefs and from Mr. Archie is, look at what a terrible job that Mr. Archie did, I'm sorry, that Mr. Mano did in his summation.
Mr. Farrell.
Mr. Farrell. My apologies.
That's all right.
He hasn't touched the other prong of Strickland, which is prejudice. He's got to prove both. It's his burden. And the evidence against Mr. Palullo is simply overwhelming. Hundreds of incriminating wiretap cases. His principal assistant and co-conspirator, Mr. Leshner, testifies for several days about how they violated the securities laws. Mr. Roberts, who went along with the fraud for the first part of it, comes in and testifies about why this was extortion. Anthony Busick, the auditor who was going to come in and independently review the books and sign off on the financial statements for the SEC filing, said, I unfortunately didn't stand up to Palullo. He forced me to fraudulently certify these financial statements. And Ken Stein, another individual who did stand up to Palullo and who wrote these phony valuations. The evidence was completely overwhelming, and that's why Mr. Archie hasn't even grappled with the prejudice prong, because he can't.
So forgive me, I'm not sure if we've divided up your time, because you're going to want some time to deal with the Maxwell issues. But I would like to hear, since the CAFA issue is not coming up until rebuttal, there's no violation of the statute here. Their most plausible argument is there's some due process problem with just waiting a while. What's your response to that? I mean, is there no prejudice? Is it that they consented to it? Why do you think that if we were willing to entertain a constitutional problem here, why there'd be no problem with the government just waiting, and the statute has no deadline? Does that mean you then get to wait forever? Maybe not. So tell us why it wouldn't be fundamentally unfair to delay the forfeiture here.
And Judge Bevis, I hate to say this, but that's Mr. Keller's issue. I've got the CAFRA issue.
You've got the CAFRA.
He's got the process issue. So
okay, that's fine. That's fine. I'll let it go.
As long as we know who's on first and what's on second. That's fine.
Okay.
So which part of the CAFRA issue are you going to speak to?
I'll speak to the entire CAFRA issue. And my first point is that I think it's clear, and I don't think Mr. Archie, I'm not sure he's arguing otherwise, that the CAFRA issue, let's assume that we violated the CAFRA statute.
Well, he did not. He's going to deal with it on rebuttal.
Yeah.
The CAFRA issue.
Who's got the burden here on the CAFRA issue?
Are you talking about the issue where before the Judge Kugler's order, the property that was confiscated before the order?
The claim,
that's what I see is the CAFRA issue.
Yeah, the CAFRA issue, I guess, is a mixed question of law and fact. Judge Kugler made certain findings. He held an evidentiary hearing. He had documents about Mr. Cedrone's letter to Mr. DeGuano, our response, and he made findings about that. So to the extent he made factual findings, it's reviewed for clear error, and if it's a mixed question of law and fact, that's de novo.
So are the lack of any statutory requirements for civil judicial forfeiture proceedings, does that present some kind of a gap that Mr. Archie's client can say, a la Langbourne, wait a second, there's a 3-year gap here. It can't be the case that you can take something and hold on to it for 3 years. Let an asset waste like a yacht, let it sink, sell it, get insurance. You know, that can't be the way the law works. Who does that fall on? Is it on the government to come in and justify that, or is it on Mr. Archie's client to come in and say, wait, stop? How's that work?
So the government, unlike in Langford, the government got a seizure warrant from a magistrate to seize that boat. They submitted a lengthy affidavit explaining why the boat was proceeds of the fraud, and the magistrate signed off on the warrant, and we executed it, and we got the boat. Mr. Palullo had a remedy to that seizure if he thought it was wrong. He could have filed a motion for return of property under Rule 41. He could have filed a motion for an improper forfeiture action. He could have walked into court and filed something. He could have filed a claim with the government saying, you took my boat unlawfully. I'm starting the clock here on your obligation to respond, and CAFRA lays out deadlines for all that stuff.
At that point, while you're moving forward, you get that magistrate judge's order. Help me out here, are we in criminal forfeiture land? Are we in civil forfeiture land? Are we in non-judicial forfeiture land? Where are we?
We are not in any of those yet. We've just seized
some other nether region.
Well, we've seized the boat.
On what authority?
Under the authority of the warrant.
You got to stand for him. I'm a simple guy, right? And I'm pretty sure the government's not allowed to just issue a warrant and start taking people's property. There's got to be some foundation to say, and you said a minute ago, it was the proceeds of the fraud. So it's acting to forfeit property under some authority. Now, is it at the authority that it's got under the civil forfeiture statutes? Is it the authority it's got pursuant to its criminal forfeiture authority? Or is it some administrative authority? And if it's not any of those three, what is it?
It has seized the property in anticipation of seeking criminal forfeiture, which it ultimately did. There's no statute of limitations that says once you seize this property, you've got
to take care of it.
We have to take care of it, and admittedly, we entrusted it to a third party who didn't do their job and allowed it to sink. And I don't think there's been any allegation that third party entity was not an appropriate custodian. But if the government seizes property in anticipation of filing criminal forfeiture counts against it, and the person who owns that property, either because they're an innocent party, an innocent third person, or because they think that the government is not going to be able to establish that this is proceeds of criminal activity by a preponderance, it's the obligation of the claimant to come into court and say, this is an unlawful seizure.
Okay, I got you. Mr. Cedron said...
We'll take care of it later.
Yeah.
Right. We'll reserve our rights, right, but we're not asserting them now. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Huff?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Michael Huff. I represented William Maxwell and I'm here to argue on behalf of William and John Maxwell with regard to severance and the La Cosa Nostra evidence.
You want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
No rebuttal, 12 minutes, I think.
That's fine.
Thank you so much. So, as the court is aware, Criminal Rule 8B of procedure does permit the trial court or the government to consolidate defendants and bring one indictment against numerous individuals, just as long as the crimes charged or alleged from a single series.
Right. But you're not alleging joinder was improper. You're saying there should have been severance. We review
That's
severance
exactly
right. for abuse of discretion.
That's correct. That's
so
right.
So one of the questions related to the discretion is, would separate trials even have helped? The co-conspirators' acts would still have come in to explain the scheme, the motive, all of that. Why is severance not just, why is it imperative if most of this is coming in anyway and just going to make redundant trials?
Well, I agree that co-conspirator statements can be admissible, right. Could have been admissible in our case, but if there was a separate trial. But I think a lot of that La Cosa Nostra evidence would not have been admissible in a trial of the Maxwell separate.
Right, but normally there's a very strong presumption in the law that jurors follow limiting instructions. Outside of some narrow context like Bruton, we presume the limiting instruction will work. So did you ask for limiting instructions on the things that you're now saying were prejudicial?
We asked for limiting it. We asked that the trial be severed. That was denied. So our only remedy at that point in order to effectively represent our clients is to ask for those limiting instructions.
Okay.
Got it.
And
too,
we did.
Right?
Yes.
And didn't you, in fact, get them over and over again?
That's correct.
Then why doesn't the strong presumption that jurors follow their instructions take care of this?
Well, this was a six-month jury trial, as the court is well aware, and the jury trial itself, constantly the jury was hearing about evidence of La Cosa Nostra, of the mafia. In fact, although Mr. Gross says that Mr. Palullo was the one who was really calling the shots here, and then he kind of threw in Mr. Scarfo there towards the end, Mr. Scarfo was at the top of this indictment. The criminal investigation by law enforcement dubbed this case Operation Sunblock. They also referred to this as the Scarfo-Palillo Enterprise.
But isn't one of the problems you have here is that this jury seemed to know how to compartmentalize very well, perhaps in response to the jury instructions, perhaps in response to the limiting instructions. For example, Mr. Mano was acquitted.
In fact, the three lawyers were acquitted.
The three lawyers were acquitted.
Well, my,
right.
My client's lawyer, too, at the time was. So I think the difference is there is that, Mr. Maxwell was the attorney for First Plus Financial Group, and he was really involved in, like, the day-to-day activities of running the company. Mr. John Maxwell was on the board of the directors of First Plus and was also the CEO. So the Maxwell brothers were really involved intimately with First Plus Financial Group.
True. And isn't that exactly the point, that the jury was able to look and see, well, as to Mano, as to those the other two whose names are escaping me, right?
Mr. Adler,
right,
and Mr. McCartney.
Right, thank you. That we can see they're lesser involved and we don't think they're guilty of these things. They go through the trial, they're acquitted.
But
they didn't think that about the Maxwell brothers. They thought they're in it, and they're in it up to their eyeballs, and they get convicted. So why isn't, especially given the fact that there are repeated limiting instructions, why is it that severance was something your clients were entitled to?
Well, I think the facts that the court is pointing out, the fact that some of these individuals who were acquitted and weren't as nearly involved in the running of the company as the Maxwell brothers were, that is the spillover effect where the jury's going to look at the Maxwell brothers and say, well, they were involved with Mr. Palillo, with Mr. Scarfo, clearly either made members allegedly of organized crime or associates of organized crime. So because these two individuals had such a close working relationship with these individuals, they must be guilty too. And that is
Wait
the prejudice.
Second, Mr. Huff, is the logic then of your position that anytime somebody is a co-conspirator with somebody who's got mob ties, they're entitled to a separate trial?
Well, I'm not sure
where the stopping point is for you, because the rabbit seemed to go in the hat when you said, yeah, they were involved day to day, and therefore the taint of La Cosa Nostra was there. I mean, those two things are not necessarily related. In fact, that's your whole point. And why couldn't the jury just say, and why shouldn't we accept, in fact, that the jury did say, mob or no mob, these guys were involved day to day in a massive set of RICO predicates, and therefore they're liable.
Well, I think that the court would have much more faith in the jury verdict had separate trials been ordered, because then you would not have necessarily had the taint, for example, of the government's mafia expert who came in and told the jury about the assassination attempt of Mr. Scarfo in 1989. You would not have had necessarily the expert coming in and describing the hierarchy of the mafia.
Why would you not necessarily have had information, though, about mob ties if as the government, and they'll speak for themselves, indicates that in their briefing that this was all essential to give the jury appropriate background about the conspiracy, why the conspiracy formed and why it operated the way it did, why Mr. Palillo was willing to give money to Mr. Scarfo for virtually nothing, why
it was significant that the communications were operating the way they were and money was flowing the way it was. If all that's true and they're part, your clients are part of the conspiracy, wouldn't a great deal of this information make it in? And I say this information, I mean La Cosa Nostra evidence, make it in, whether there was a separate trial or not?
I don't think it would have been admissible to the extent that it was in this trial. I do not think that we would have had an anonymous jury. I don't think we would have had the mafia or organized crime expert. Certainly we wouldn't have had the one juror who decided in the middle of the trial that she was too afraid to go forward because of, you know, fear of to herself or her family and ended up having to be believed. I don't think we don't.
Is this to your client in that? I mean, was your client entitled to have juror number eight sit? I'm not sure I'm following. It may in fact be true that some stuff wouldn't have made it in, but the anonymization of the jury, what?
Well, I think that we had an anonymous jury because we had, you know, supposedly, you know, real life mafia people sitting in the courtroom, and they wanted
to prejudice your client one way or another. How does that turn into jury? How does that turn into taint?
I'm saying that it would have been a different trial. It would have been a different trial. We would not have had that expert testimony. We would have not have had that anonymous jury. We would have had it. This trial would have looked significantly different.
I'm coming back to Judge Jordan's question. How does your, I mean, the black letter law is there's a strong preference for joint trials and multi-defendant cases. You're not denying that. But what you do seem to be saying is any case involving organized crime or violent gangs would seem to qualify for a lot of these same things. And then we'd have to have a contrary presumption against joint trials in any of those cases where there might be fear, where there might be experts in how these organizations work. And that's just contrary to the many cases in our reporters that have repeatedly affirmed joint trials in these kinds of cases. What makes your case different, or are you really asking us for a norm of severance in those cases?
Well, the cases that I review that deal specifically with La Cosa Nostra, with LNC, or LCN, in most of the severance arguments that I see that are being made are, you know, because, you know, some of the other predicate acts are murder and other defendants aren't charged with murder, and so they want to get out of the case, you know, because the evidence against some of the co-defendants are going to be much more severe than against the defendants who are moving for severance. And so I have not personally seen a lot of cases where you have individuals like my client, who is an attorney in Texas, like his brother, John Maxwell, who had been a business person his entire life, that somehow get mixed up with these crime figures and end up doing business with them. I have not seen those cases.
Okay, but there are cases out there where there's a bookkeeper or an accountant or the person who runs a trash hauling firm that gets taken over. There are lots of, that's what RICO was designed for, with, you know, organized crime getting involved in legitimate business. So you're going to have the little bookkeeper, the little accountant, the little tax preparer, the garbage hauler, the guy who runs the bar on the corner, who were legitimate business people and then got mixed up one way or another. So how is it different? It's not different because they're from Texas, right? How does your rule not wind up reaching all of those cases contrary to RICO's desire to kind of get them all in?
Well, I do think the district courts do need to take into consideration whether or not all the defendants in the case are members of a gang or organized.
Didn't Judge Kugler take that into account?
Yes, he did, and we think he made the wrong reason, which is why we're, or made the wrong decision.
How is this any different than a court making an analysis under Federal Rule of Evidence 404B?
Well, I think that is what, that was the analysis that Judge Kugler used.
And how is this, isn't that the correct analysis?
I believe, yes. I think the government argued it was intrinsic. He came down on the side of 404B. And what Judge Kugler said was that, you know, he was allowing this evidence in to show the how and the why and the motive as to, you know, why this alleged crime took place. But that was not the Maxwell's motive in this case to be involved. Was, you know, as any businessman would be, was to make money. Palullo and Scarfo allegedly had other motives, which was to kick money up to the Lucchese crime family or to, you know, maintain their status within organized crime. That was not the Maxwell's motive.
Well,
does it matter if it was the Maxwells' motive or not? The Maxwells decided to get on the train. Once they decide to get on the train, if the engine that's pulling that train is LCN-related motives, it doesn't matter whether the Maxwells wanted that particular engine or not. They chose to get on the train, and they have to deal with the background evidence that helps explain to the jury what's going on in the case, including a description of the engine, so to speak. So why is it unfair somehow for the Maxwells to have to deal with the fact that they choose to be co-conspirators with mobsters?
Well, because ultimately we want to make sure that the jury's verdict is was not tainted, was not prejudiced by the mission.
That's why there were so many limiting instructions.
I understand.
And one could argue that's why three lawyers were acquitted.
Right. Well, again, the argument is the reason why all of the LCN evidence, all of the mafia evidence was admitted into court was to help prove Palullo and Scarfo's motivation. And then that was improper spillover prejudice that affected the Maxwells in this case, who did not share that same motive. And they were left, even with the eliminating instructions, I understand, even with those instructions, they're left to sit there and deal with, a jury expert coming in or an organized crime expert coming in and saying, oh, this person was, there was an assassination attempt. He was attempting to take over the Philadelphia Mafia. He fled to North Jersey to seek protection under the Lucchese crime family. He has an interest now in taking over the Philadelphia Mafia. And this was the scheme that they were using to pay tribute, in all those things. And they have to sit there and, you know, they have to deal with that, and they have to be worried about that spillover effect, that prejudice, that birds of a feather flock together. But the
jury separated out the birds.
Well, that again, I would argue that the individuals that were found not guilty were so far really removed from the day-to-day operations that doesn't really prove very much.
Anything further?
That's it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Keller. Well, I think total, we're left with like 21 minutes total. How much time of that?
I think I kept four for this issue, Your Honor.
That's fine.
Not due process, but...
Four. Thank you.
Let me begin by apologizing. I could not remember the name of the witness who knew about the ultimatum and stuck his head in the sand. It's Mr. Stein, the business broker, pages 4736 to 37 of the record. Let me move on to due process. And let me again start with a question that Judge Bibas asked. There can't be a due process violation when the balancing test of the four factors has factors 2, 3, and 4 cutting against the defendant. Because even though there was a delay here, even though there was a seizure of the yacht and the Bentley, and
a delay of what, like 41 months?
41 months, a very long time, no question. Less than some cases in which there's been no due process violation found. 5 years is one of them, but it's a long time.
Yeah, and not just a long time, but a long time in which substantial assets turned into...
No question about that, which is why the Supreme Court has said no one factor in the four-factor balancing test.
And a long time before you even got an order.
Well, I think Mr. Gross alluded to this, and I think one of the most important factors to consider is that was a strategic choice on the part of Mr. Palullo. He sent a letter right after the seizure in May of 2008, starting the process to reclaim his contested property. He then thought about it.
Let's assume that's true. But let's go back to CAFRA for a minute. I know it's not your specific issue, but isn't the whole motivation that Congress has in passing that statute to say, we are uncomfortable with the way the government handles other people's property?
So
it is troublesome that they walk in and take people's property and then decide, you know, we'll get around to telling you whether we're going to keep it or not, and maybe it's going to be worth something when we're finished with it or not, but we're bothered by that, and so you got time limits. And now what we hear the government saying in this case is, yeah, he could have come in and said something, but he didn't, so it's okay for us to hold this for 42 months and watch the boat sink, and it's no problem, because that's not a due process issue. It's just tough luck. That's sort of the argument is how it's come across.
Well,
where At what point does due process kick in if it's not when you say to somebody, you're going to wait years, and in the meantime, something that was worth a lot of money is going to be worth nothing?
I don't think I can answer that question any better, Your Honor, than to go back to the fact that to address those very problems that you so pointedly brought to attention, there's a four-factor test, and the length of time is one of them. And if the defendant was bereft of any remedies, the problem would be far worse still. But the defendant is not bereft of remedies. And here we know that on day one, May 2008, he invokes his remedy. And then on day two, June of 2008, he withdraws the invocation of his remedy. Why? I think the record's very clear on this. It was just a strategic decision. Why was it made? Because
he didn't want to expose himself to civil depositions, right? I mean, is this a heads we win, tails you lose situation? You can assert your rights, but if you do, of course, you're doing it and we're going to depose you, and you realize, of course, that you're under investigation criminally, so you really can't do that, and therefore you know, it's kind of an interesting position, Mr. Keller, because the assertion that's being made is he should have exposed himself to civil discovery, in which case he would have had to invoke the Fifth Amendment or sink his own metaphorical boat, or sit quietly, and then the government can sit on the boat, literally, for 42 months and let it sink. So how is that not creating due process challenges for us?
Again, I understand the issue, and you pointed out extremely well, and the answer has to be what the Supreme Court has articulated as the other factors that you have to look at. And the second, the reasonableness of the delay matters, all right? And I don't think anyone here is challenging the reasonableness of the length of time. The challenge is it fair for the property to be in the government's hand during the entire period? And I take the point. But then you have the fact that he specifically withdrew the remedy. I'm going to reserve my right. I can re-elect to assert it at any time. There's consequences to that, but then you go on.
That doesn't really seem to me to be answering the question. He does reserve his rights, but it's a reservation, and you're right, it's tactical. It's got to be. It's got to be a choice, right? No sane person says, before the criminal stuff is resolved, okay, I'm going to come in. All you can do at that point is reserve your rights. So why don't we shift gears for a second and assume for the sake of discussion that we thought, maybe there's a due process problem here. Is there a remedy? What would the remedy be?
Well, let me step back and answer that question this way. The assets actually vested in the government at the time of the commission of the crime. Mm-hmm. So I have to point that out in terms of where we're balancing the equities. There's no dispute about that. The yacht, the Bentley, and the other assets were directly acquired with the proceeds of the criminal enterprise and their acts of extortion and all the other predicate acts. There's no doubt about that. The government owned them at that time.
Sure. But was it if the government owned them at the time and the government said, we don't care where that boat sinks. We don't care where we took a $2 million boat and we took it and we turned it into a $400 dinghy. That's our boat. We can do with it what we want. We can set fire to it if we want. Assume that's true. Is the government still entitled to say, and forfeiture amount remains the same? We took the physical assets. We let the physical assets waste. You still owe us the full amount.
Well, one of the physical assets surely did waste. We know that. The rest of them did not. There was a plane involved. There was money involved. Right, so one of them clearly did. And then the question becomes, what consequences flow from that? And the second piece of the answer I was starting with is, in addition to the government's ownership interest vesting at the time of the criminal acts that allowed them to get the assets to begin with, is you don't have a Sixth Amendment issue here, for sure, because you have no Sixth Amendment right to obtain counsel with contested assets. But that takes us immediately to this, Your Honor.
Okay, because you're answering something I'm not asking. I'm trying to get to assume. Just assume with us that we thought there was, in fact, due process problem.
So the four-factor balancing tips against the government.
Yeah. Just take that as a given for sake of argument. And that our concern was limited to the asset that wasted. What's the – is there a remedy? What would we do with that? Would we say, well, this has to go back to the district court for some fact-finding to say a reduction in the forfeiture amount? What do you do? Do you just say, it was bad, but it's too late now, boat sunk? What happens? Nothing?
I have not thought about that before. So this answer on the fly is worth the time I've spent thinking about it. I suppose one remedy would be an offset in the value of the lost asset if you think there's a due process valuation. So that maybe you have to send back down for a limited purpose to offset the amount that otherwise is owed by the amount of that asset. Because right now I can't think of a better answer for you. That's one.
Is there a practical problem with that in that you've heard Mr. Gross say, we're never going to get the forfeiture. Mr. Pulello can't possibly pay restitution and then have money for forfeiture. Well, so it doesn't matter how much he owes. This is not a trick question. I'm really trying to think through the thing with you.
I understand.
Would we remand under those circumstances, or could we say, there was a problem here, but this is a problem with no practical remedy because it's never actually going to hit the defendant?
Well, I think there's some truth to that, but I think the other point is it's not one that goes to the validity of any of the convictions, right? They stand regardless because this does not go to any of the jury findings. And so the question then becomes, what limited remedy is there? Offset is the one I've offered. It may not be that practical. I'm acknowledging not having thought it through, not to have a better one.
We're going to have to write an opinion that covers not just the conviction. It's got to cover all the issues, right? We're going to have to deal with this issue too.
I'm not minimizing it. I'm just pointing out the distinction that I'm drawing. And on this one, there's a practical problem you've identified. I offer a possible solution, but I haven't thought it through, and I certainly haven't researched it. I apologize for that. But I don't have a more crisp answer for you at this time.
That's okay. Thank you, and I appreciate my colleagues indulging me, and I'll be interested to hear from Mr. Archie what he thinks a practical solution might be, too.
Are there other questions on this that I can address?
No.
Then thank you very much for indulging me.
Thank you. I think because we went substantially beyond the 4 minutes, from take away 8 from 21, so leave 13 for Mr. Gross. And if we have more questions, we'll go beyond that, so it's no big deal.
Severance. This court sets a very, very high bar to a defendant in an abuse of discretion for denial of a severance motion. And Mr. Huff simply hasn't met it. And the district court could not have abused this discretion when looking at this case, looking down the road at a 4-5, or what actually turned out to be a 6-month trial, and realizing that it was going to have to do almost that entire trial again if it severed. Was going to have to ask 16 or 18 jurors to sit through that twice. It's going to have to ask a very busy district court judge to sit through that evidence twice. And had there been a separate trial with only the Maxwells, and let's set aside for a moment the LC evidence, but if there had been a separate trial with just the Maxwells, well, there's only one scheme here that they weren't involved in, and that was the bank fraud, whereby Mr. Scarfo and Mr. Pulullo and some other people, Drosner, got together and lied about Scarfo's wife's assets, and they got this mortgage. The Maxwells weren't involved in that, so that would have been out in a separate trial of the Maxwells, but that all of that evidence is found at the joint appendix C7587 to 8132. That's about 500 transcript pages out of 8,850 transcript pages in the government's case in chief. So we're talking about less than 6%. So you're going to have to redo this entire trial again with the Maxwells if you sever. And the district court, exercising its discretion, can say that's just not an appropriate severance, when I can deal with this prejudice of the LCN evidence with a limiting instruction. Not only a limiting instruction, but Judge Kugler engaged in very thorough voir dire in this case and talked to the veneer people about their preconceptions about La Cosa Nostra. And anybody who said, you know, I don't think I can be fair in a case involving La Cosa Nostra weren't even subjected to the individual voir dire. They were out.
Mr. Gross, can you respond to the bright line rule argument that was made by your opposing parties here, Maxwell's, that Judge Kugler's ruling in effect created a bright line that anytime somebody is indicted along with somebody that's got LCN ties, the LCN evidence is always going to be admissible because it will always be important to explain how the organization works. It will always be important to talk about paying up the ladder. So anytime you're indicted, you're always going to be getting the full Godfather treatment, so to speak.
Right. And if Judge Kugler, who wrote a 30-page opinion in this case, had said, that's the bright line rule that I'm applying here, then I think that might give this court some pause. But, of course, he didn't that. That wouldn't be appropriate to have a bright line rule. And there's no basis for this court to be concerned about the creation of such a rule in this case. He appropriately considered, we did substantial briefing on the severance issue. We pointed to all of this court's precedents and Zafiro, the Supreme Court's case. And he appropriately took into consideration the balance that he's entitled to and required to strike between efficiency of judicial proceedings against potential prejudice against some of the defense. And he struck it in favor of a joint trial in this case. And that's not an abuse of discretion. That's not arbitrary or irrational. Now, with respect to, and your Honor's questions, I think, really hit the nail on the head here. We have a couple of problems for Mr. Huff. There is a very thorough and limited instruction. It's basically a whiteout instruction to the jurors. You cannot consider any of this LCN evidence against anyone except for Scarfo and Poole. And that's something that this court is going to presume that the jury followed. And in this case, there's evidence that they followed it because they acquitted Mr. Mano, who's a mob lawyer.
Isn't that a little like that old New Yorker cartoon that shows the jury just agog and people shocked and falling out of the jury box and the judge is saying, I direct you to disregard that last statement, right? I mean, yeah. Is this the kind of evidence that it's impossible to not bleed over?
It's not, Judge Jordan. It's not shocking to anybody that La Cosa Nostra is a criminal organization that sometimes engages in violence. I mean, that's not shocking in the way that some other instances, and I guess I'd like to refer the court now to the Bailey case, which I know Your Honor is very familiar with, where Judge Irenas allowed in evidence of basically a snuff film. The jury actually had to watch an individual being murdered in the courtroom. Cunningham, another case where the evidence was so shocking that the jury couldn't ignore it. And not only was it shocking, that the horrible sadistic brutality in that case, but there was no need for it. It was duplicative. It was cumulative. Same problem we had in the Bailey case. But here, the LCN evidence isn't duplicative. It's necessary. It's vital evidence to establish why Scarfo is making all this money, even though he's not putting in any elbow grease. And Judge Jordan, I agree with you. When we're explaining to the jury how this sort of singular and unique conspiracy occurred the way it did and why the different people played the roles they did, we could have put that into evidence in a separate trial. And not only that, but I think that the Maxwells actually benefited to this extent from a joint trial. They got this limiting instruction, the wipeout limiting instruction. In a separate trial involving the Maxwells, they wouldn't have gotten that limiting instruction because the Maxwells actually did know about and have some involvement with La Cosa Nostra, especially William Maxwell. William Maxwell and Sal Palullo went down to the federal prison in Atlanta and met with Nicky Scarfo Sr. And then William Maxwell came back and said, you know, oh, I'm going to represent this former mob boss and help get him out of prison, and that's really going to make my practice take off. So one of the reasons why William Maxwell was in this and why he admitted that he was happy that he was in it is because he's going to get some mob money out of this. And John Maxwell also can't claim that this CN evidence didn't apply to him. There was that crucial conversation in which Palullo is on the phone with Adler, and they're talking about how they're going to get the proxies voted, and Palullo demands that Maxwell gets on the phone, and he says, and starts giving Maxwell orders and to go out and round up these proxy votes, even if people are on respirators, and he said, this is coming from our friend back Jersey. That's Scarfo. Everybody knows who that is. So they're not naive here. They know exactly what train they've hooked onto, and it was not unfair this LCN evidence came in. And out of an abundance of caution, the government agreed to this wipeout limiting instruction. This is an instruction the court can presume the jury followed, especially when they acquitted several of the defendants. The LCN evidence is not gruesome the way that the evidence in Bailey and Cunningham was. It was somewhat anodyne. Terracciano testified about how LCN families are organized, and he testified about this recorded conversation in which some mob said, Scarfo, yeah, he's a made guy of the cases. So Mr. Huff simply can't meet his very high burden to show an abuse of discretion. And unless it's a very similar argument with respect to another issue that the court asked for argument on, was the admission of the LCN evidence, was that so prejudicial to the Maxwells that they're entitled to a new trial? And I'd just like to make two points on that. One is, I don't think that William Maxwell can bring that issue now. John Maxwell briefed it in his opening brief. William Maxwell only said he filed a statement in his brief under Rule 28I, saying, me too, I'm joining in all the issues. But the issue of whether you're prejudiced by this evidence really depends on a lot of other things, a lot of the other evidence, how the case was argued. And for William Maxwell to say, I was prejudiced by LCN evidence because for the same reasons that that Palullo and John Maxwell were, that isn't sufficient to preserve the claim. So I think with respect to him, that issue is out.
Doesn't the issue apply somewhat more to John Maxwell than it does to William Maxwell?
Well, John Maxwell certainly briefed the issue, and so he's entitled to have this court review it. And I would agree that John Maxwell is less invested in the LCN aspect of the conspiracy than his brother is. But by the same token, government never argued in summation. We closed Mr. DeGuano closed for the better part of 2 days. And he never violated that limiting instruction. He never suggested that either John Maxwell or William Maxwell had any ties to the mob, or that LCN evidence should be used by the jury to convict them. So unless the court has any other questions, if I could just spend a minute addressing Judge Jordan's question about due process and what's the remedy here if you find a due process violation. And I think that I'm not sure remand is necessary. I mean, what if you wrote an opinion that said 41 months is too long, you allowed this boat to sink, the value of the boat has been substantially diminished, Mr. Palullo is entitled to the benefits of the value of that boat. The problem with that is that the jury decided beyond a reasonable doubt that that boat was forfeitable proceeds. And so, at most, Mr. Palullo had some interest in possessing the boat for that period between when it was seized and when it was when the jury found that it was ordered forfeited. But he's certainly not entitled to the full value of the boat. So if the court said, well, there's some monetary value that can be ascribed to that four-year period.
The monetary value, the diminution of the value of the boat because the government let it sink.
Right.
I mean, I understand your, hey, we got somebody else to take care of it. We thought they were reliable. But look, that's, you know, if one were to look not charitably on that, one might say, well, that's on you, right? You pick a bad Bailey, then tough for you. Your Bailey wrecks the asset. You pay the price for wrecking the asset.
Yeah.
But if we thought, and I'm not saying we will say, because I got some questions from Mr. Harchi, too, on this. But if we thought the Barker slash 8,850 and whatever dollar test did weigh in a fashion that brought us to a conclusion that there was a due process violation, then wouldn't it kind of compel the conclusion that you don't get to forfeit the value of something you actually had and let waste, that somehow there would be an offset? Now, I mean, isn't that, I mean, it feels like that's a logical conclusion that's tough to get away from, isn't it?
It is. It okay. is, I agree.
But as a practical matter, if your earlier assertion is correct, that we are never getting to forfeiture because Mr. Palullo can never demonstrate he actually has the assets to pay restitution, let alone forfeiture, does any of that matter?
No.
And then how do we address that? What do we say? What does a court say if you've got a real problem like that? You say it's a real problem, but it doesn't actually affect the defendant. There's no prejudice there because he's got no money anyway to pay
the court, it. If the court wants to issue an opinion that says, hey, government, you know, when you seize property,
you got to take care of it.
You got to take care. If you don't take care of it, it's the defendant is not on the hook for the full forfeiture that it would otherwise, you know, be on. That's certainly appropriate. You know, let's say, you know, that there's some dispute down the road as to whether these additional individuals have paid up the full restitution amount. Now we're into forfeiture. Mr. Palullo certainly would have, I don't think that there is a bar, I'm not sure about this, whether he could go into court and petition for a reduction in the forfeiture amount and say, the Third Circuit said that they violated my due process rights by not indicting me for 41 months, and during that time period, the value of this boat sank, and so that should be deducted from the amount of the forfeiture that I owe. You certainly could do that, but I don't think at this point you can order relief. You can order Judge Kugler to alter the forfeiture amount.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Ruffy.
Thank you.
I think you have 10 minutes.
Sitting here trying to calculate like Afra and honey cutting my brain. I'm like, you know, so.
You're talking about calculations. Right. First of all, the government's right that you didn't argue any of these calculation issues before now, right? That's an issue that you just forfeited until now.
Well, I think we did in terms of loss amount calculations.
Where did you preserve that issue?
That's in our brief, Judge.
It's in your brief before us?
Yes.
Was it ever argued at the trial court?
Yeah, we argued over loss amount during sentencing. Absolutely, Judge.
Did you challenge the government,
We challenged the whole procedure, Judge.
Okay, I don't see an objection. Can you cite me to anything that you preserved or objected to when the district court calculated the loss amount there? You submitted some numbers, they submitted numbers. The district court picked a number. Did you object after that point? Anywhere you can cite?
I don't think I can cite exactly to it, Judge.
All right.
I would have to look at the transcript.
I couldn't find an objection, right. So I think you're on plain error. But right. Go on.
But, Judge, we're talking about CAFRA. We're also talking about Honeycutt. Just when I think about it, now we're talking about this boat, and they made, I don't know if they conceded that we would be right in that and use recalculation, but with Honeycutt, if Honeycutt says if you're a leader or organizer, you get no reduction, then how do we get a reduction then? It should all count for it. That's the problem I see with this whole situation.
No, Honeycutt, look, I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth, right, but for sake of time, if my my good colleagues here will allow me, I'm gonna do a poor job, but a stab at saying what I understand the government's position to be. I understand their position to be the Honeycutt issue, which is the joint and several liability issue,
right,
cuts in favor of the government because in Honeycutt, the Supreme Court gave the example of the wicked marijuana-growing farmer who is liable for the full amount, even though the college student is only liable for part. And therefore, we're in that situation here. Mr. Palullo, your client, he's running this show. So he's like the evil marijuana-growing farmer and is at the top and is liable for everything.
Right.
Honeycutt, done. Joint and several liability issue is done. As to your client, he's liable for everything with respect to the forfeiture. That's what I understand them to be saying. Now, once you take that spot, if you take that spot, and the question becomes, okay, that forfeiture amount, that $12 million, $12.1 million, whatever it was, forfeiture amount, you know, he's liable for all of it. And he's liable for all of it on top of any restitution, you start to get into the practical problems. That's where the CAFRA issue comes in, Mr. Archie. And my question for you is it fair to say, was there anything other than the boat? Because I didn't see, I mean, there's the Bentley is an asset that's potentially.
It was a Bentley.
Yeah.
There was a slew of computers.
Right. But I'm talking about an asset that was, that you could look at and say, that asset definitely wasted. It's only the boat that I saw pointed to.
Well, the Bentley would depreciate it, Judge. It's still sitting in a garage to this day, as far as I know. I mean, if it was a 2008 Bentley, it's 2021 now. I mean, how much is it worth?
It is worth whatever the government says, because they didn't destroy it, right?
Right.
It's the car. We're not. It seems unlikely that the law requires the government to send an appraiser in every year to value the what a car or something like that is. But an asset like a yacht, which sinks, it's clearly worth something when it's floating, and it's worth nothing when it's underwater or very little. Unless I guess you wait 500 or 600 years and you call it a Spanish galleon. But we're looking at a real loss, and the question is, do you have any basis, if we thought there was a due process violation, do you have any basis for saying, well, I could actually be liable for that. I could end up having to pay that value. Or do you agree with the government that your client's never going to be paying that value because he's never going to be able to get past the restitutionary amount?
I disagree, Judge. Mr. Palullo, like I said at the very beginning, he made $8 million before the government even showed up at his doorstep on his case, selling a company. So I believe he's capable of getting out of jail and resurrecting himself. He's owned companies. He's did reverse mergers. He's a pretty bright guy. I don't think he's just going to be, you know, a maintenance man somewhere.
Is the government right that they can collect the restitution and the forfeiture so that we would be talking about $26 million plus by the time? So you got the likelihood,
I think
the possibility?
The forfeiture was $14 million. I think restitution was $12 million, right?
Other way.
Or the other way. I mean, there was, just say $14 million. There was only one $14 million. I don't know how you get to $26 million.
Because the government has said that restitution comes first, there's $14 million, and then they are entitled to the forfeiture amount on top of that. That's my question to you. Are they right or wrong about that?
I think they're wrong about that, Judge. There's only one amount. I mean, is there interest being calculated here?
Mm-hmm.
So where did they get the $26 million from? There was only one $14 million total.
That's where they get it from, 14 plus 12. Now, yeah, I'm not a math whiz, but I'm pretty sure that's
what I understand the calculation. The question is, how do you get the extra?
So I'm not sure this is even preserved, but let's say it's preserved,
right,
or we overlook that. Why wouldn't that all be dealt with by simply saying, look, we're going to instruct that you got to credit it such that whatever there is, that's forfeitable, you pay it in, and it knocks down the restitution amount, and the same amount gets credited. Why isn't this just a crediting problem of computing that the, you know, the probation office takes care of, as opposed to something that needs to be, have the judgment amended based on all these amounts that have been paid or something like that?
Judge, respectfully, I think CAFRA says you don't even get to that, because the CAFRA statute says if you blow the statutes, if you don't follow the letter of the law, there's the, you lose the asset. It's almost like a suppression issue. You're supposed to give it back. The guns were on the boat. I mean, I think it should all be suppressed. We've laid that out in our brief. So you get a credit for something that I believe on CAFRA should have been given back. And Palullo.
Let's talk about preservation for a bit.
Right.
You, opposing counsel argued with some force, May 2008, Palullo says, hey, wait a minute. June 2008, he withdraws the request. Why shouldn't we treat that as the issue is not preserved here?
Because CAFRA doesn't say it's reserved. I mean, you could say, I could have a client that's cooperating and a statute of limitations 5 years is coming up. And I'm like, oh, we'll deal with that later.
But your client can sign a waiver of the statute of limitations.
Exactly, Judge. He can sign a waiver. Speedy Trial Act, you can sign a waiver. There's no waiver here whatsoever written. It's just the government saying that Mr. Cedrone implicitly waived CAFRA.
We didn't. Well, he sent a letter. Implicitly, he explicitly said we're not asserting that you should give us the boat back now. We may ask for later, but we're not asking for
right. that. Right. Well, saying we may ask for later doesn't mean we waive all our rights.
It's at least a forfeiture. It's not. You're right. It may not be a waiver, but it's at least a forfeiture.
So. Does the panel have any other questions for me? As far as Mr. Farrell, I know...
I actually do have one.
Yeah,
one more. Because under those Barker factors, one of the factors is the reason for the delay. Is the reason for the delay here, the 41-plus months, or maybe as much as 42 months of delay, something that can rightly be ascribed to the unavoidable complexity of the case because of your client's behavior, massive scheme, and therefore not something that should be taken as a due process violation?
This case was figured out before they raided them. All you got to do is read the search warrants. They had this case down to a T on May 8, 2008. When they raided across the country and seized all these assets, that was all the evidence. There was no superseding indictment. There was no additional charges that came out of this. When they raided in May 8, 2008, they had everything. And it took them until 2011 to indict them. In the meantime, the boat, like Mr. Palullo says, sunk to the bottom of the ocean when it really just took on water. But
did anybody object to Judge Kugler's entering of the complex case order?
I don't think we objected, Judge, no.
I don't think so either. Okay. Thank you very much. Those are all the questions I have.
Just on Mr. Farrell, again, we think it was prejudicial. I know Mr. Farrell, he had testified that his lawyer told him that he did not have to tell anybody. But Mr. Fiorante came in and said, in fact, he did tell Mr. He would never tell Mr. Farrell that. So his performance was abysmal. He left a heavy burden on me, and Mr. Palullo was extremely prejudiced by it.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you to all counsel for a very comprehensive oral argument. I know we went much longer than the usual oral argument, but it has a whole lot of issues in addition to the ones we talked about today. So thank you all for being with us, and we'll take the matter under advisement and recess the court.